Good morning, everyone. It's a delight to be here worshiping with you all. I grew up in Sunday school being taught the song, God Sees the Little Sparrow Fall. Did anyone else learn that song as a child, God Sees the Little Sparrow Fall? I remember learning that song and singing it a lot, but I don't think the church really took that song to heart. I can't remember a time wherever I ever learning anything in church about how to take care of animals in the way God did. What I did learn was that Adam and Eve were supposed to rule over the animals or have dominion over them, but how that was to be applied in today's world was a big blank. No one really mentioned that in sermons. I saw the church caring about people who were hurting. I really got that message strongly. But there was no indication that we should care about animals or creatures that were hurting. Some theologians think that Christians have taken the word dominion in the wrong way. There are two ways to translate the word dominion in the Bible, or the word to rule. We've basically taken one meaning, which is the meaning that it can sometimes have in the Bible, like the Philistines had dominion. And basically it means, I'm the boss of you. I get to do what I want. It's my call. But there's another way that dominion is used, and that word can mean to be shepherding or caring. And so King Solomon, when he's crowned, he's told that he should have dominion over his kingdom, which means do justice, you know, take care of people. And the word dominion is used to describe God's actions. And God has dominion over the world. God has dominion over us. And God cares enough about us to send his son to us. So what does dominion really mean? Eugene Peterson, in his translation of the Bible, writes about dominion this way. He says, take charge. Be responsible for fish in the sea and birds in the air. If we are to have dominion like God has dominion, that means we have to care. But then what does that mean for this congregation? What does that mean for each of us as we live our life in this world? What does it mean for us to be Mennonites, to be a peace church? I want to tell you two stories today. And the first one is about pigeons. I can guess already that you think that's a boring story. Because who cares about pigeons? Pigeons are everywhere, and you don't give pigeons a second thought. You aren't really interested in pigeons, are you? Well, let me tell you about this very special pigeon, a pigeon named Martha. Martha died in the Cincinnati Zoo at 1 p.m. on September 1st, 1914. She was the last passenger pigeon in the world, as far as we know. Passenger pigeons were beautiful birds. They were related to pigeons, but they were not exactly the same species, sort of related to mourning doves, but a bit different. They were named by the first French explorers that came to North America. They were named after the French verb passager, which means to pass by. This magnificent North American bird passed by in flocks that went overhead. They were the most prolific bird species the world has ever seen. They migrated in groups bigger than any other migrating creature, second only to locusts. Researchers estimate that when Europeans came to North America, there were 5 billion passenger pigeons in North America, and they lived in the woods. And of course, North America, before white people came to North America, the boreal forest stretched from coast to coast to coast to coast. Passenger pigeons spent their winters in the south, close to the Gulf, and in the north, they came to Canada. They were found from the Maritimes to Saskatchewan. They really liked the Great Lakes area. Have you seen giant flocks of birds? Think about the kids here. Have you seen a giant flock of birds? Right around now, there are lots of starlings flying around. Maybe you've seen them fly in a flock, and you've seen them, and they kind of float together. It's so beautiful, isn't it? When I was in Manitoba once, in southeastern Manitoba, I saw a flock of snow geese, And it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life because they filled the sky. They just filled the sky and they were white and gray and beautiful. I just stayed and watched them for a whole hour because they were so beautiful. But snow geese migrating is nothing compared to what passenger pigeons looked like. Here in southern Ontario, in 1866, someone documented a flock of passenger pigeons that was 1 mile wide and 300 miles long. It took 14 hours to fly overhead. 14 hours, it just kept going. You may not believe that. You think, that's crazy. How can it be that big? It was that big. That is how big flocks were, and there were numerous documentations of that, especially the first explorers that came talked about these amazing birds. What did passenger pigeons look like? They had a red chest, and their backs were kind of a metallic gray, sort of with a bluish head, and their feathers were iridescent around the neck, and their chest was dark red, purpley color. They were bigger than a mourning dove, and they were big enough to eat. Passenger pigeons reproduced and traveled in such large numbers as a type of protection. They were simply so many of them, they outnumbered their predators. They were easy to kill, but their species could absorb a lot of deaths because there were so many of them. And it's kind of the same idea as caribou herds. Is there so many caribou herds? Yeah, sure, the wolf will come and get a couple, but the herd is so big, it overwhelms the predator population, and it keeps on going even if some straggle away. Same thing with passenger pigeons. And this all worked for the passenger pigeon for tens of thousands of years until the Europeans came along. They started cutting down the forest, which was their habitat, so that was a problem. But the main problem was that Europeans were hunters. They had weapons, and they had transportation, and they had communication. Human beings had railways. And they started killing birds not just to feed the local people, but to feed people in cities far away. Hunters killed passenger pigeons and put them in train cars and sent them to the cities. There was simply no end to how many passenger pigeons could be eaten. And human beings had the telegraph, and so they could tell each other where the birds were, and so hunters would go there and hunt them, because they knew exactly where to find them. Professional pigeon hunters traveled all over North America, United States, and Canada. Whenever someone found a flock, word would get out and hunters would come. The hunters kept records, and between 1866 and 1876, when passenger pigeons were already in decline, they harvested 10 million pigeons a year. Even when the flocks started getting smaller and smaller, some people were trying to conserve them and regulate their hunt. People disregarded the rules and kept tracking them down, even in their nesting areas. The last large flock was noticed in Petoskey, Michigan in 1878, and 50,000 birds a day were killed every day for 5 months. After that, only smaller flocks were seen, and professional hunters tracked them down and killed them before they could reproduce. Conservationists felt the only thing they could do was capture some and try to keep them in captivity, but they're a type of creature that needs large flocks to reproduce, and they wouldn't reproduce in captivity. And so before long, all the birds in the wild were gone. The last recorded sighting in Canada was of a lone passenger pigeon in Penetanguishene, in May 1902. The last passenger pigeon documented alive was in the Cincinnati Zoo, and they called her Martha. And on September 1st, 1914, at 1 p.m., Martha, the last passenger pigeon, died. God made passenger pigeons. God sees the little passenger pigeon fall. Human beings saw the passenger pigeon fall. We made them fall. We destroyed them. We thought, who cares? I don't care about pigeons. It's just a bird. Or maybe we thought, there's so many of them. We can't make a dent in them. Or maybe when the numbers dwindled, we thought, they'll bounce back. Or maybe all we thought was, there's a tasty dish. Or who cares if they're gone? We had dominion over them in the sense of, we are the boss of you, and not in the sense of, we will take care of you. We did not feel responsible for passenger pigeons, and we did not treasure them. We knew so little of the life cycle of that bird and how it fit into our shared environment. We didn't understand the nature of flocks and how they needed flocks to reproduce. We didn't understand how a species can reach a tipping point and cannot come back. Why did God create passenger pigeons? We may never know. The whole North American ecosystem was able to support them. It was the most amazing bird population the world has ever seen. And within 100 years, the bird was gone. James Audubon, the great naturalist and artist, many of you have seen his drawings. He lived in the 1800s. He wrote about the flight of passenger pigeons. So listen to his words, because he saw it. The dense mass which they form exhibits a beautiful appearance as it changes direction, now displaying a glistening sheet of azure when the backs of the birds come simultaneously into view, and then suddenly presenting a mass of rich, deep purple. God made their glowing colors. God made their tiny wings. No one living today can remember witnessing one of the most amazing mass migrations, a marvel. We not only haven't seen it, we don't even remember that we don't see it. We've forgotten about the passenger pigeon. Who cares about it? There was a voice here and there that said, hey, save the passenger pigeon. But guess what? It wasn't churches that said that. Churches didn't think it was their business. Maybe we didn't do anything as churches because there isn't a specific verse in the Bible that says extinction is a sin. There isn't a commandment that says, thou shalt not cause extinction. But extinction in biblical times was unthinkable. Human beings were simply not that numerous or powerful. They could push animals away, but they couldn't destroy them completely. Extinction is totally a modern concept that we have come to understand in the last couple of hundred years. Even in the Bible, though, you do see ideas about conservation. And that's why I had you read this, the little verse about what do you do when you come across a nest. It's important to only take the eggs or the baby birds. Leave the mother so it can keep on breeding. I mean, it's common sense. It's common sense, and it's there. I think for the most part, the Christian church has turned its back on other living creatures. Many species have gone extinct, not just the passenger pigeon in the last 100 years, and the church has never said a thing. It's not our problem. Christians have been busy saving souls. We don't have time to think about blue whales and tigers and polar bears and western chorus frogs and lake sturgeon. Someone else should do something about that, right? We pass by on the other side. Here's my second story. A few years ago, I was in Mexico, and a friend of mine has a sailboat, and he took us out on the coast on the Pacific Ocean. It was on that side of Mexico. And we went around 3 miles offshore, and we started fishing. I'd never really been in an ocean-going sailboat before. It was thrilling, and we had 5 lines in the water. And after probably an hour and a half of waiting, we got a tug on one of the lines, and our friend gave the line to my husband, and he worked to bring that fish in. And it was a hard job, took around 15 minutes, and a lot of strength. I don't think I could have done it. I wasn't strong enough. But my husband brought this fish in, and it was huge. It was 20 pounds. It was a tuna. It was fat and beautiful and strong. It was really hard. Even once we got it in the boat, we weren't sure we could keep it because it was flopping around. It was just an amazing creature. I'd never seen anything like it. I'd never seen a live tuna. I'd eaten tuna all my life, but I'd never even thought to look in a book to see what a picture looks like of a tuna. And here it was, like this magnificent creature right in front of me. So then after we got it, we wanted to go fishing some more, and we decided to change spots. So we sailed down the coast a bit, and we came across three big ships, and they had cranes on them. And I said, what are those ships doing? And my friend said, those are tuna boats. And he explained, and while we were sitting there for another couple of hours, we watched the tuna boats working. And they're big enough to have helicopters on them. They're like ocean liners, really. And the helicopter goes up and circles around and looks for a school of tuna. And then the boat goes to where the tuna is. The helicopter radios back. The boat goes to where the helicopter is and drops a net 1.5 kilometers wide and circles the school of tuna, closes the bottom, and then with the giant crane brings up everything that's in that section of the ocean. They can store 4 million kilograms of fish in a tuna boat. Of course, they haul up everything in the sea, dolphins, turtles, all the other types of fish. As I watched these big boats, I started to feel sick. Those tuna didn't stand a chance. There were 3 big boats. And yet here I was on a boat with a tuna too. After that experience, coming home to the supermarket, I didn't have an appetite for tuna anymore. I haven't bought tuna since then. I just can't. I think about those boats. Also, I have pet cats. I've been buying cat food my whole life, and I always bought tuna because cats like that. But I can't buy that kind of cat food anymore. There are 100 million pet cats in Canada and the United States. Why should the oceans be drained of fish to feed pet cats who in their natural life could never catch a tuna? And of course, that doesn't make any sense because cats can't catch a cow either. But we feed them beef. But at least cows, we breed them for food. They aren't wild animals. And cows aren't going to become extinct because of the way we take care of them. But wild tuna is a $42 billion industry in the world, and over half the species of tuna are endangered. Scientists think that tuna populations are on the verge of collapse, just like the cod are. As I'm talking, maybe you're thinking, I'm anxious about so many things already in my life. Now you want me to care about every living creature? That's crazy. You can't do that. Why are you laying this guilt trip on me? Animal extinction is a big problem, but maybe God isn't asking us to care for every creature, just the creatures that God puts in our way. Reminds me of the story of the man who fell among thieves on the road to Jericho. I can just imagine the priest and the scribe passing by, thinking, I simply personally cannot care for every wounded person in this world. It's impossible. I have enough things to be worried about. But the point of the story Jesus told was that they didn't have to care for everyone. They just had to care for one, the one God put in their way, and they chose not to. I know I simply personally cannot even think about or care about every endangered animal, but God has brought the tuna to my attention. Maybe God is going to lay one creature on your heart. Will it be a local bird like the shrike or the monarch butterfly? Or maybe a spotted salamander? Or maybe it's something more exotic, a tiger or a blue whale like we saw today. Have you ever seen a wild creature and felt a special connection in some way? Maybe that is an invitation from God to care. To care about that creature and its ecosystem, and to let that creature shape your life in some way. I think God wants our church, our churches, to be filled with animal lovers, with bird lovers, with fish lovers, with insect lovers, people who take responsibility for creatures, treasure them, care for them, and listen to their voice. They are our fellow creatures. I love Psalm 104, which we read today responsively, because it's a hymn for the earth and all its creatures. I just love how it talks about badgers and tigers and human beings and trees and how they're all woven together, living together happily. You know, that psalm was written before we had the word ecosystem, but I think it describes what an ecosystem is. We are conjoined with the creatures of the world. It's our world together. If we eradicate species, I think it's blasphemy. It's taking something holy and beautiful and saying, you're worthless, you're garbage, and we can throw you away. I have a vision for the church. I hope that we can stand up and say something about animals. Be a strong voice for conservation, for birds, for insects, for our local flora and fauna. As Mennonites, we are a peace church and we identify with the defenseless, and there is nothing more defenseless than living creatures, because they cannot have a march, they cannot organize a lawsuit against companies that are exploiting them, they can't even tell you that they're dying. All they do is they disappear. Martha took her last breath in the Cincinnati Zoo, and their species was over. Will we, as Mennonites, stand with the truly defenseless? I invite you over lunch today to have some conversation. Have you seen the church caring for animals, or birds, or insects, or fish? Think about in your life. Have you ever heard a Peace Sunday about taking care of fish, or taking care of animals, or insects? On today's Jericho Road, what creature have you come across? And how might that connection be a call from God? Maybe this week, this year, you will thank God for that specific creature. You will pray for them. You'll inform yourself a little bit about them. A Wikipedia search does not take that long. Maybe you will find out more about their environment. Maybe you will feel God laying something on your heart to change your life and the choices you're making. We'll do this as a way of having dominion, because having dominion means I care for you. Remember, God sees the sparrow. And the question the church faces is, will we? Thank you.